on this week's program, we listen back to a conversation with Simona Dinnerstein, where we talk about a computer-generated re-recording of Glenn Gould's legendary performance of Bach's Goldberg Variations. Dinnerstein's own recording of the Variations has been on the classical music charts for almost 20 weeks. Jason Pfeiffer takes us to the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia, and Susan Lewis visits an exhibition of the works of the prominent late 19th century Italian painter Antonio Mancini at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
There are currently two CDs featuring Bach's Goldberg Variations in the classical music charts. The latest Glenn Gould CD is a new recording of his great 1955 performance of the Goldberg Variations. The original mono disc has been recreated in stereo by a company called Zempf, which takes audio recordings and turns them back into live performances, claiming to precisely replicate what was originally recorded. The software-based process extracts every musical nuance of a recorded performance and stores the data in a high-resolution digital file. Then, using a Disclavier, a sophisticated computer-based player piano, plays back and records the computer's performance. The other recording of the Goldberg Variations is by Simona Dinnerstein, and it is, ironically, the more successful of the two. We invited Simona Dinnerstein to listen to both the original 1955 Gould recording and this new Zempf computer performance and tell us what she thought. I first asked her what struck her initially as the difference between the two versions.
First, of course, the quality of the recording. The recording quality is completely different. It's very, very clear, and it has a kind of a little bit of reverberance in it, which is not present in the 1955 recording. And I personally like hiss, and I like all of those, the sound of an old recording,
right.
And I like his grunting and groaning. I love hearing him making his noises. I mean, there are no noises, obviously, in this new one. But it was interesting also because the piano sounded wrong to me, the instrument.
Which it was.
Yes, and that...
We should explain, the original one was on, we believe, on a Steinway, and this was a Yamaha Disclavier.
So. Yes, and it was a little odd hearing his playing on a different instrument. It threw me off somewhat. And then the instrument to me, now, I didn't know what it was I was listening to, but it sounded artificial to me, especially the bass. I don't know why, but I was trying to think, why did it sound artificial?
But just as you just said, listening to him play in reference to this. So subconsciously somewhere you've decided that this is Glenn Gould, or have you? Is this a machine playing this?
This is a virtual Glenn Gould, isn't it?
Well, supposedly.
There was something very bizarre about it because it was Gould in a way, but it was also almost a caricature of Gould, I felt. Like, especially listening to some of the passages where he has like running notes in the bass line, it sounded very sort of digital to me. And people always talk about, this is the interesting thing, so many people talk to me about how Glenn Gould's playing is digital. And I don't think his playing is digital at all. I think that he was...
You mean mechanical?
Mechanical and very even and kind of clipped. But I think that his playing is actually very, very shaped, and he was an incredibly sensitive pianist. I mean, sensitive to touch. And I don't think of his playing being digital. If you really listen to his recordings, it's not all about being even and being a series of notes that are played with perfect equality. It's not like that at all. But on this recording, that's what it sounded like, and that was a little strange. I couldn't figure that out because supposedly it's recreating exactly what his touch was, which makes me wonder whether the sound of the instrument itself was making it sound too, I don't know, the quality, it didn't have his sound. It sounds somewhat like a synthesizer or something like that. I don't know.
Let's listen. Is there a particular section that illustrates that? And we'll play one from the original 1955 recording and one from this re-performance.
Yeah, I would say variation 3, if you listen to the bass line. It's kind of strange.
excerpts from both the original 1955 Glenn Gould recording of the Goldberg Variations and a new Zempf computer re-performance. Let's now return to our interview with Simona Dinnerstein. Her recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations is currently riding high on the classical music charts. We last met her on Creatively Speaking in March, and I asked her how things had changed with her newfound success.
I think that there are a lot of different things going on right now. I think part of it is because of the intensity of the past few weeks since the recording was released. I've been interviewed an awful lot about how I play the piece, and I feel a bit self-conscious about it now. And that's kind of, I spent a long time trying to get away from thinking about what anybody else thought of my playing. I mean, I stopped studying, it's like 10 years ago now, because I felt I was being too influenced by, I was too influenced by what I wanted somebody to think about my playing, a teacher or another person. And I felt that I was not going to really become a full musician if I kept on thinking that way, and I needed to really just listen to myself and form my own opinions. And somehow, suddenly, I'm kind of being inundated with everybody else's opinions about how I play this piece, which people seem to feel is somewhat controversial, and I didn't think of it that way at all. I didn't set out to play it to make a controversial statement. I just was trying to play it in a way that felt true to the music for me at that time. And so it's been a little strange also because I didn't listen to the recording in a while, and then I listened to it again, and I realized that I'm playing it differently now. And then that got me to thinking about, you know, I've just been thinking a lot about my own playing, which is probably not a good thing to do. You know, I think it's really, I can't complain about what's going on right now. It's very exciting and I'm really thrilled and it's wonderful. But I could see how people become kind of closed off or
as Glenn Gould did for the last 20 years of his life.
Yeah, and I've been thinking a lot about what he said about why he became an exclusively recording artist. He felt that his playing changed through playing concerts and that he was playing to the public. And I notice when I'm performing the piece that I have to be very careful about that, that I don't do that. And I didn't ever really notice that so much with other programs, but there's something about this piece of music. Perhaps it's because you're also sustaining your focus for such a long period of time. But it has a lot of challenges, and I think that also keeping your focus and keeping it, making it special, and hearing how special the music is, it's very important to hear the music as if for the first time when you play it. And if you're playing it like a few times a week, performing it, then you have to somehow rid your mind of what happened in the last concert and it's all new, all over again. And that's very hard, especially if you're playing on instruments that are not ideal or, you know, you're feeling a little uncomfortable because you've been traveling and, you know, you wish you were home or I don't know, or there's somebody in the audience that, you know, you wish wasn't there. but it's a journey. I'm going to be curious to know how I feel at the end of the season, having performed it many, many times.
Final question. Why did you record such a controversial version of the Goldberg? Simona, as usual, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Great talking with you. Thanks.
An excerpt from the third Goldberg Variation. That's Simona Dinnerstein's latest recording of J.S. Bach's great work. It's available now on the Telarc label.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Although much celebrated at the turn of the century, by the mid-1900s, Antonio Mancini was all but forgotten by the art world. Now, an ongoing exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, prompted by a large gift from a collector, surveys the achievements of this Italian master. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers why Mancini fell off the map and what factors make a great artist famous.
Antonio Mancini's large oil paintings in some ways recall masters like Rembrandt, realistic figures with intense highlights plunging into shadows. Yet Mancini's style and technique were anything but traditional. Colors, often bright and bold, were thickly swabbed and globbed onto the canvas. In some paintings, he incorporated bits of glass, metal foil, or other materials.
He's an artist who really has one foot in the world of the old masters and one foot in the world of modern painting.
Ulrich Hiesinger is guest curator for this show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and a key player in the matchmaking process that led to it. Hiesinger was a longtime friend of the late art dealer and collector Vance Jordan and was named artistic director of Jordan's estate, which included 15 major works by Mancini. Antonio Mancini is no household name, even in museum circles. Joe Rischel, the museum's senior curator of European painting, says the acquisition of these works was more serendipitous than planned.
Ulrich was charged by the terms of Mr. Jordan's will to go out with the understanding that these would be given to an institution, a major U.S. institution, if they agreed to do a show putting these objects in proper context and do a publication around them.
The museum does not ordinarily like to accept gifts with conditions, says Associate Director for Collections Alice Beemstrafer. When a gift is proposed, there is a multi-step evaluation procedure, beginning with an individual curator and ending with the approval, or not, of the full board of trustees.
The process is very intensive because we're making a huge commitment.
The commitment in this case was deemed appropriate in light of the significance of the gift.
I think what was compelling about this gift was, first of all, the importance of Mancini as a kind of neglected figure, and also the fact that Vance Jordan had such a nice concentration of his work.
Aware that it was in competition with other institutions, Rischel says the museum made a strong case because while Philadelphia had no other Mancinis, it did have other paintings that could provide a rich context for his work.
Be they Swedish, German, Dutch, French, or in the middle of it all, Sargent.
John Singer Sargent, highly renowned in Europe, less well known in his own country, would turn out to be a major factor in Mancini's later success. Meanwhile, Mancini was forging his own path, pursuing il vero, the truth. Mancini was never part of any movement or school, says Ulrich Hiesinger, although he was aware of the trends of the time.
For instance, in the 1870s, he was in Paris. He knew Degas and Manet and so forth and was introduced around to virtually everyone. And yet he stayed very stubbornly resistant to any influence from them.
Instead, Mancini, guided by the old masters of his schooling, pursued his own vision, shaped in part by his humble background and hard times. Born in Rome in 1852, Antonio Mancini and his family moved to Naples when he was 12, where he studied at the city's Institute of Fine Arts. He produced his first major oil painting at 16, the over 6-foot-high work, Street Urchin, the beginning of a line of paintings that Joe Rischel says demonstrates one of Mancini's distinctive contributions to the art of the time.
It's one thing to paint poverty, it's another thing to paint it from the inside, the lost ones, those urchins that he paints. And they're heartbreakers, they really are, and they're meant to be. And it's not voyeuristic or anything, it's a projection on his part. He is one of them.
This early period culminated with a painting of a boy in silver, gold, and white circus costume, his arms folded, a thoughtful expression on his face. Ulrich Hiesinger says this painting, now a part of the Philadelphia Museum's collection, is the most famous of his Neapolitan works.
It's called Il Saltimbanco. There was a traveling circus called the Cirque Jouyon, and they actually had street shows as well as tent shows. So Mancini developed a number of subjects from his encounter with this circus world.
Mancini made several trips to Paris, where he exhibited this and other work, but was disappointed in his reception there. Eventually, he left, even painting a picture called Adieu Paris.
He said, I had to flee from working for the Paris dealers. He felt himself threatened and compromised by the kind of work he felt he had to do in order to earn a living. That's the picture, I think, that really encapsulates that. He was trying something to please a public, an imagined public, with a kind of work that he wasn't comfortable with.
Back in Naples, he was institutionalized in a mental hospital for 4 months. Shortly afterwards, he moved to Rome, where he began experimenting with different techniques. One was the use of what he called a graticola, a wooden-framed grid of threads or wires that he would set up in front of his subject and on his canvas as well. Although he said it was an aid to perspective, he would also sometimes paint through the grid, which would leave marks on the canvas. But both Rischel and Hiesinger say that the technique that set him apart from traditional gentility was not this, but the bold way in which he applied paint.
The amazing freedom and audacity with which he puts on these huge amounts of paint onto his surfaces, and how they somehow fuse together into very powerful images and very, very convincing and moving images.
Look at those surfaces. There's nothing suave and buttery about these. Now, these are in-your-facey kind of thing, and a little crazy. It made people terribly nervous to have their portrait done by him, because he would leap around and jab the canvas and slam it on.
In the late 1800s, Mancini began to attract the attention of American dealers and investors, thanks to the continued support of John Singer Sargent. His work appeared in major exhibitions in Venice, Rome, and Naples. In 1929, the year before he died, the Italian government named him Accademico d'Italia, the country's highest civil honor for artists and intellectuals. This show of more than 40 of the over 2,000 works Mancini created ranges from large formal portraits to a number of self-portraits, to figures in casual moments, to items of dinner dishware, which on closer inspection reveal greater meaning. Mancini's late-life success came in large part from the support of private collectors and dealers, who Joe Rischel says play a huge role in the fate of an artist, particularly in the case of someone bucking established trends.
For if you are not within a salon in Paris or Royal Academy in London, if you don't have that institutional protection, you're even more dependent. I mean, then as now, you can paint all you want, but you have to find a conduit of that out into the world.
While private dealers eventually enabled Mancini to thrive, it is institutional support that keeps work in the public eye for generations to come. And so a gift like this from Vance Jordan may be a triple blessing. It enriches the collections of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, gives a neglected artistic master his due, and gives wider public exposure to perhaps one of the most underrated talents of the 19th century.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Antonio Mancini, 19th century Italian master, is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through January 20th. Philadelphia is today a major hub for commercial, educational, and cultural activity, and this has long been the case. But what has made Philadelphia into such a vibrant urban center? History suggests its proximity to the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers, and in turn the Atlantic Ocean, played no small part in the city's development. The Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia explores the rich maritime legacy of this region and takes a look at the ruggedness of life on the sea from a variety of perspectives. Now WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer takes us there.
The Seaport Museum was originally founded in 1960 as the Philadelphia Maritime Museum by the late J. Wells Henderson, a Philadelphia attorney from the city's Germantown section. Inspired by his summer jobs during college as a longshoreman on Philadelphia's waterfront, Henderson saw a need for a public institution that represented the maritime history of the Delaware Valley. Unlike many cities in the Northeast, Philadelphia had no museum to honor its maritime past, so Henderson decided to create one himself. With a collection of artifacts, books, and paintings, the museum had three different homes at various locations during its first 35 years. In 1995, the museum moved into the refurbished Port of History building at Penn's Landing, and the Philadelphia Maritime Museum was renamed the Independent Seaport Museum. Craig Bruns is curator of the museum. He says that Philadelphia's geographical location and the fact that it's a freshwater port has both benefits and drawbacks.
Philadelphia is located 100 miles inland, which is a good thing. That means that goods, instead of just going to the shore, are actually unloaded 100 miles inland, 100 miles more inland than New York is, or any of the other ports. But also, it's 100 miles away from sea, which makes it a bad thing. Because it's a river, it freezes, and that has been very difficult for commerce in the past. During the winter months, the port was closed. The other ports were not closed. But it was a safe harbor, being 100 miles in, away from the storms that would plague the ocean and damage the ships.
Runn says that in early America, before the railroads, waterways were the highways. Roads were not built very well and rather dangerous, so rivers like the Schuylkill and the Delaware were essential for transporting goods.
Eventually, New York took over, primarily with the development of canals. But early on in American history, Philadelphia was the center of the East Coast.
Philadelphia's history as a major port for trade and commerce is just one of the topics explored in the exhibits of the Independent Seaport Museum, which is located just off the Delaware River near Philadelphia's Old City. The permanent displays include a look at the science of boating, the history of Philadelphia as a port for immigration and a home for the shipbuilding industry, an exploration of undersea technology through the ages, and a collection of boats indigenous to the Delaware River Valley. Craig Brunn says that one prized possession of the museum is a decorative wooden carving of a full-length female figure from the prow of a 19th-century ship, created by Philadelphia sculptor William Rush.
This figurehead is one of a very few that exist of his work. He's more known now for his sculpture at the Art Museum and various places around town, but really, most of his output were ship figureheads. But all of those, as ships themselves, have disappeared. So we're lucky to have this one.
The Seaport Museum is not limited to exhibits, however. It also runs a working boat shop dedicated to the skills and traditions of wooden boat building and sailing. John Brady is the boat shop manager.
We specialize in boats from the Delaware Valley and the New Jersey shore, but we're not limited to them. Most of the work is by volunteers. We do a lot of that. I'd say we see 2,500 to 3,000 volunteer hours in here a year. Anyone who wants to can come down and learn how, if they can put up with me and deal with a day of sandpaper.
Brady has been with the boat shop since it opened in 1995, repairing and restoring wooden watercraft like old summer camp rowboats, workboats for oystering, and racing boats. Brady explains while many kinds of vessels pass through the shop, some old, some more modern, the skills needed to work with wooden boats haven't changed much.
The tools that you see in here are all electrically powered, but the main difference between our tools and the tools of, say, 1890 are that. They would have been steam-powered. Ours are electrically driven, but they had all the same stuff. And so the techniques that we're using are very much the same as they were then.
Of course, many boats are not made of wood, and the museum celebrates that dimension of maritime history as well. Visitors can climb aboard the USS Olympia, a 344-foot-long steel warship anchored in the Delaware River by the museum. Built during a time of peace, the 1892 cruiser was Admiral Dewey's flagship during the Battle of Manila Bay in the Spanish-American War. Decommissioned in 1922, today it's the oldest steel warship afloat in the world. The steam-powered vessel was sophisticated for its day. It features two luxurious cabins for the admiral and the ship's captain, and it was designed to accommodate about 400 men, essentially making it a floating city, complete with a machine shop, a ship store, a laundry facility, and even a dentist's chair. Standing in the engine room of the warship, historic ship's manager, Jesse Lebovics, explains how the Navy men communicated as they operated this large vessel.
Radios, telephones, all like that didn't exist at the time of this boat. There were some very primitive telephone rings. It was speaking tubes, and then everything else was bells. So there were various complex systems to describe what a bell was telling you, and there were different size bells that made different noises, and that was the emergency backup.
Floating alongside the USS Olympia is a World War II submarine, the Bakuna. It completed 5 wartime patrols in the Pacific Ocean and is similar to the many submarines built by the U.S. Navy in Philadelphia.
The dive alarm right here. It's called a Claxton. They don't use that sound anymore. three times, and then you say dive, 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 down you go, and then you do it again.
Launched in 1944, Jesse Lobovic says the Bakuna was built during World War II to win World War II.
That was her function. So she's very stripped down, it's just the bare minimum, nothing extra. The boys say with great pride that this boat actually had an ice cream machine on it, which put it well above a lot of the other submarines out there. But it was a hardship. What I find astounding is all of our old veterans still remembered as some of the finest times of their lives, even though it was clearly pretty hard.
Living and working on the water has always been both compelling and difficult, from Navy life to the journey of immigrants to the tough work of professional seafarers. The Independence Seaport Museum celebrates the role of water in our history, the people who have called it home, and those who carry its traditions forward.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.